Radioactive nuclear waste. What a mess. That's what gets created at any and every nuclear reactor. Plutonium contaminated material that lasts literally for tens of millions of years and is deadly to the life and health of people and the environment, causing cancer, autoimmune diseases, birth defects, DNA damage, and more. We don't know how to safely store it or neutralize it, and we're stuck with tons of the stuff, and more is produced every day. How did we allow it to get this bad? Weren't we warned about the consequences of running nuclear reactors? But then a Canadian mathematician, physicist, and nuclear consultant fills you in, and he tells you,
during the first 30 years of the nuclear industry, there was never any discussion about nuclear waste. In fact, decision makers and the public were told that this was a clean technology. And consequently, it came as a shock in the mid-1970s when people realized that they had been had, that all of a sudden they had an industry which had the most toxic waste that any industry has ever produced on Earth. And it turns out that describing the industry as clean was at best a euphemism, at worst a lie.
Well, when Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility lets you know not only how we got into this nuclear pickle, but what's wrong with Canada's attempts to site and build a nuclear repository, you start to realize that there is not yet any way out of that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we examine the problems and nuclear industry manipulation around Canada's push to site a radioactive nuclear waste repository in the middle of Indigenous lands. We talk with Dr. Gordon Edwards, head of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, and Alicia Petrone, a board member for Mining Watch Canada and a member of Niniwatamin Anishinaabeaki, which means we stand for the land, an Indigenous-led group dedicated to stopping the disposal of nuclear waste in Anishinaabe territory. We also have an update on the auction of the radioactively contaminated Zahn's Corner Middle School in Piketon, Ohio, talking with Vina Colley of Press. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been mentioned at the Democratic National Convention. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We start with a follow-up to the ongoing story of radioactive contamination from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, Ohio. It contaminated the nearby Zahn's Corner Middle School with radioactive materials, including plutonium and americium. The problem was so bad that the school was forced to be shut down in 2019. But the local school board recently decided to unload the liability and offer the school for auction, with an asking price of $275,000. Activists rallied to oppose this, and the one known potential buyer, a Christian school, was contacted by attorney Terry Lodge, who had worked with local groups on this issue, and Professor Michael Ketterer, who had discovered the contamination. These two men provided all the biological and legal reasons why the school should not be bought. Within 24 hours, this group decided against bidding. However, there was another group in play that the activists did not know about, and that's what we're going to learn about now. I spoke with Vina Colley of Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security, or PRESS, on August 17, 2024, the same day as the auction. Vina Colley, today was the day that the Zahn's Corner Middle School, the school that was closed because of radioactivity found in it from the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant being demolished and the contamination that spread from there, that middle school was put up for auction today. First of all, who is in control of that property and decided to auction it?
The school board is the one who is in control and has to give permission for them to buy it.
What was the thinking behind them putting this known to be contaminated property up for sale?
I think it's just been a headache and a lot of money involved in the cleanup, and they didn't know what to do with it. And so they put it up for auction, and Vineyard Ministry bid at $275,000. That was the bid that came up. They were the only bidders. And it's unbelievable. He took his small kids into this auction, into that school. And this school has killed 11 kids already. So I don't know what he's thinking.
You're talking about the man who's the head of that Christian ministry.
Yes.
And also, I saw something that you wrote, that the church is known for its recovery programs. What does that mean? And to what use do they plan to put this school?
It's a rehab. The minister has a rehab. And I'm looking at him, in my opinion, that he wants to put a rehab in there, which he would make a lot of money on rehabs through Medicare that takes care of the rehabs, and he'll get his money back. But I'm not sure where the money's coming from.
What was the feeling or the sense within the community, first of all, when they found out that this school, Zahn's Corner Middle School, which was closed down 5 years ago for radioactive contamination, was actually going to be sold to the highest bidder?
We were shocked. We just could not believe it. And we protested 3 times now at the school.
What kind of protests were they?
And we were on the side of the road with signs. No nuclear signs was on my car. Some of the community people that came out that had cancers, they had signs saying no nukes, and we're victims of this hazardous plant.
Were state or local health authorities in any way involved in giving permission or allowing this to take place? Or did they have any power in this at all? Or did they just turn a blind eye to it?
It looks like everyone's turned a blind eye to it. Now, they may have had some private meetings, because after this meeting today, after the auction, the school board called a meeting and they said it was an executive session or whatever, and they would not allow me to video what they were saying. And they were only in there like maybe 5 minutes. And what that was on their agenda was to okay the sale of that school. Now they'll have to take it back into a couple more sessions, but they all voted to let that school go. And I asked them, why haven't they sued the Department of Energy? Why aren't they making them get rid of that school and put it in those waste sales or whatever? But no one wanted to touch on that.
There was actually a previous ministry that wanted to buy the school and had expressed interest in it. And they received a very brilliantly worded letter from attorney Terry Lodge, who has worked on this issue for decades now. And the Pike Christian Academy, upon receiving that letter, I think within 24 hours, made the decision that they were not going to be involved. Did the Vanguard Ministries also receive a copy of this letter? And did the school board members receive a copy of this letter?
Probably they did not, because we didn't know that another Christian ministry wanted to buy the building. And when it came out today at the school, there was one bidder, and they were the only bidders on this school. But I know also Dr. Ketter called that other ministry and talked to them about the contamination along with Terry's letter and along with all of us protesting out there. It helped shut down that ministry, the first one. But this second one, it just came from nowhere. So I'm sure it was in the planning and they just didn't want to tell people.
Is it possible that by getting Dr. Ketterer to speak with them and to get the Terry Lodge letter to them, that they might be able to say, oh, wow, we didn't know it was this bad. This was in bad faith and we're backing out?
Well, I don't know how they can say it's not this bad, because Ketter just released a report that we have neptunium and plutonium and americia 15 miles off site. The other thing that's been bugging me is, how come they haven't tested any of the other two schools that's real close there, and all of these homes that are next to this school there in Science Corner? They haven't tested any of those. And then they put the school up for sale. It just absolutely makes no sense. Evil. And they want to make it look like we don't have a problem. So, oh, looky there, they sold the school. There's no problem in this community. There's no homes that are contaminated. There's no kids with cancer. There's no problem here in Piketon. That's what they want the whole world to know. And the whole world needs to know that Piketon is the largest facility in the world and the most contaminated facility in the world. The cancer rate here is the highest, according to Joe Mangano, and also a study that we did as the Portsmouth-Piketon residents for Environmental Safety and Security. It showed that we had a high rate of cancer. And Joe Mangano says it's the highest in the state of Ohio, and we're 87% national here. How can they cover this up anymore?
And Joseph Mangano is an epidemiologist and the head of Radiation and Public Health Project, which has been so instrumental in showing statistically what the cancer rates are in your area.
I want to do some more investigation into this person who's buying this school. I want to see where he's getting his funding and where all this money's coming from, because I know he started out with just a little bit of money and now he's got a whole lot of money. Rumor has it that his wife even works at the plant. I can't verify that, but they said she's a guard.
Given that this has all, you should pardon the expression, blown up as of today, what is the next step for press, for your group? What are you going to be doing moving forward on this?
We're not going to stop, and we're going to continue to take samples and have Dr. Ketter to evaluate the samples that we gather. I just think there should be some type of legal aspects that we can take against that school. I can't even imagine a kid going in that school. I can't even imagine going in some of these homes anymore. And I know people are scared about property valuation, but, you know, when you have kids dying in a school and you put this thing up, we got to regroup and think about what we're going to do next. So we're not going to stop. So the DOE is fighting us all with our tax dollars. We cannot fight them because they got the money. We don't, but we're still fighting them with or without money.
That was Vina Colley of Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security, or PRESS. This story and its convolutions continue to expand, and we will have further updates for you in future episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat. Regarding this week's Democratic National Convention, no matter what happens in Chicago, Democrats will continue to support nuclear power. Here with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story is Linda Pence Gunter.
The Democratic National Convention takes place this week, and by the time you hear this report, Kamala Harris will have been officially crowned as the Democratic presidential candidate. There will have been protests over Palestine and possibly other issues, a ton of caucusing, and who knows, maybe a celebrity sighting or two. What won't have changed, no matter what happens in Chicago, is the position of the Democratic Party towards nuclear power. Almost all of the Democratic members of Congress in both the House and the Senate support the continued use of nuclear power and funding for elusive and frankly chimeric new nuclear power plants. You can practically count the anti-nuclear allies on Capitol Hill on the fingers of one hand. Actually, I'm not even sure you need your whole hand. Nuclear power has never been a partisan issue, and in a way it shouldn't be. It's wildly expensive, which ought to, but doesn't, put off fiscal conservatives in both parties. And it's a habitual violator of human rights, which ought to make it a no-no among left Democrats. But somehow, well, we know how, nuclear power has made itself a friend to all sides. Money makes the world go round, and on Capitol Hill it is the biggest spinmeister of all. Countless millions are spent each year by the Nuclear Energy Institute and other lobbyists to assure members of Congress that nuclear power is perfectly safe, clean, green, and even cheap. But surely in a democracy, if the well-heeled propagandists bearing lavish gifts can get in the door, we can too, in order to set the record straight. No chance. So we hold online congressional briefings to which members of Congress don't come. They send their aides along to report back, but who knows if they ever do or if they are listened to. And we drop literature on the Hill, trudging to every office door where, if they're Democrats, eager youngsters take our literature and assure us they will pass it on. If it's a Republican office, we are looked at as if we are from Mars, or at best like we have spinach between our teeth. They take the literature too, but we know they bin it the minute our backs are turned. I respect that for some, the razzmatazz of the Democratic National Convention and the Kamala Harris-Tim Walz ticket deliver a refreshing and even exhilarating injection of new hope and energy. For those of us trying to convince lawmakers that nuclear power is the wrong path and we don't want our money wasted on it, the deaf ears will likely remain. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In New Mexico, the world's oldest documented plutonium contamination has been found in Los Alamos's Acid Canyon, according to an independent study by Dr. Michael Ketterer, professor emeritus of chemistry and biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. Ketterer announced these findings at an online press conference held by Nuclear Watch New Mexico on August 15. He collected and analyzed soil, water, and plant samples in Acid Canyon, a popular hiking area in the middle of town. Beginning in 1943, the year the Manhattan Project came to Los Alamos, workers released radioactive waste into the canyon. Three remediations would follow, but as Ketterer's analysis found, quote, a super weapons-grade plutonium, end quote, persists in the soil, water, and plant life in and around Los Alamos, representing some of the earliest ever made. We'll have a special extended report on this next week, including an interview with Dr. Ketterer and others who have been involved in this story. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person like yourself a regular weekly dose of nuclear news you can count on to be honest and up-to-date. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. Now in its 14th year as a podcast and 9th year as a broadcast, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. We also work behind the scenes, providing links and introductions between activists, researchers, and reporters so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. You can count on Nuclear Hot Seat to provide you with verifiable, fresh information and an unrelenting perspective every week. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and we are always in need of help. So how about $5, the same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista? Or buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5, or more if you like. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. So, right now, put down whatever else you're doing and go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now and realize that whatever you do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. The tons of radioactive waste from nuclear reactor operation keeps piling up with no resolution in sight. Plutonium-contaminated spent fuel rods remain deadly for literally millions of years, and we keep making more of it every minute that a nuclear reactor operates. What to do with the waste? Well, Canada has been making plans, but they're bad ones. Here to explain how we got ourselves into this problem, what's wrong with Canada's current plans, and suggest some temporary steps that can be taken are two interviewees, Dr. Gordon Edwards, who is head of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, and Elysia Petrone, who is of mixed descent, including Anishinaabe, a board member for Mining Watch Canada, and a member of the Ninibwatamin Anishinaabe Aki, which means we stand for our land, an indigenous-led group dedicated to stopping the disposal of nuclear waste in Anishinaabe territory. We spoke on August 5th, 2024. Gordon Edwards and Alicia Petroni, thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Gordon, let's start with you. Briefly, what has been the history of Canada's attempts to create a deep geological repository for nuclear waste?
Well, the problem is that when nuclear power was first launched in this country, which was an outgrowth of the World War II atomic bomb project, we were involved in the Manhattan Project, and our first reactors were built with the express purpose of contributing to the production of plutonium for bombs. In fact, all of the plutonium from Chalk River that was produced for the next 20 years after the war was sold to the American military for use in nuclear weapons. And all of our uranium for 20 years after the end of World War II was also sold to the American military for weapons use. So it was only in 1965 that our prime minister, at that time, Prime Minister Pearson, declared that Canadian nuclear materials would no longer be used for weapons purposes. So that's when we stopped selling the stuff explicitly for bombs. But during the first 30 years of the nuclear industry, there was never any discussion about nuclear waste. In fact, decision makers and the public were told that this was a clean technology. And consequently, it came as a shock in the mid-1970s when people realized that they had been had, that all of a sudden they had an industry which had the most toxic waste that any industry has ever produced on Earth. And it turns out that describing the industry as clean was really, at best, a euphemism, at worst, a lie. So all of a sudden, it became urgent for the industry to backpedal and say, oh, yes, waste, we do have this nuclear waste, but we know exactly what to do with it. And that is, we're going to bury it underground in an undisturbed geological formation somewhere. And since the undisturbed geological formation has been safe for hundreds of millions of years, it should be safe for another 100 million years. Now, at that point, they had no proof of this at all. They had not done any digging. They had not done any exploration. In fact, from my perspective, it was a bluff. It was a bluff on the part of the industry saying, we know what to do with it, when in fact, they still, to this day, do not really know what to do with it. Because nobody denies that you can put it underground, but it's highly questionable whether it's going to stay there. And the difficulty is that nuclear waste remains dangerous for literally tens of millions of years. And the radioactive materials that are created inside the nuclear waste fuel bundles are hundreds of varieties of toxic, poisonous radioactive materials that individually can leak out. They all follow their own pathways through the environment. They all follow their own pathways through the human body. And collectively, they're capable of producing billions of human cancers, in theory, if they were dispersed into the environment freely. So the problem is that the industry wants to find a place where they can solve their public relations problem by convincing the politicians and the public that they have solved the problem. Out of sight, out of mind. If we put it out of sight, perhaps people will forget about it. And what better place to put it out of sight than in some so-called remote place where there are people living, but people who don't have a lot of economic clout. And in particular, one of the sites that they have looked at is the very geographical center of a territory called Treaty 3 land, which is 50,000 square miles of land that was not ceded by the indigenous people. They signed a treaty, this is called Treaty 3, just 6 years, I think it was 6 years after Confederation of the country, the formation of Canada as an independent country. And that treaty said that we do not cede this land, we will manage it jointly with the Canadian government. If those Treaty 3 rights are exercised, the Indigenous people of that territory should be able to exert their influence and say, no, this is something we do not want. The difficulty here is that it's being regarded by some people as a local issue instead of a regional issue. A local issue means that it only concerns local communities near where the waste is being buried, whereas a regional concern means that we're concerned about the entire region. Historically, efforts to dispose of nuclear waste in Canada have been treated as a regional issue, not a local issue. For example, in Manitoba, they chose a site to build a test repository, a deep underground repository without radioactive waste in it, but just to test the idea of geological disposal. And as a result of concerns voiced by citizens, the Manitoba government passed a law against the actual disposal of radioactive waste anywhere in the province. So they regarded it as a regional issue and they banned it. Similarly, when the United States government wanted to build a waste repository in Vermont, just across the border from Quebec, the Canadian government protested and said, we would not, Canada would not be happy with a radioactive waste repository right on the border of Canada, where the waters are flowing into Canada, which they were at that particular location. And so the government of Canada was regarding it as a regional concern and not just a local concern. And thirdly, here in Quebec, the National Assembly, which is the Parliament of Quebec, unanimously voted against importing any nuclear waste for burial in the province of Quebec, no matter where it would be. So again, the government of Quebec, the government of Manitoba, and the government of Canada have all viewed this as a regional problem and not just a local one. I was recently in the Treaty 3 area at the invitation of the Treaty 3 Council to make a presentation, and I raised this point with them, and I'm hoping that they will regard it as a regional issue and treat it as such. So that's really what we're coming down to. And the point of view of my organization is that we do not have a solution to this problem. We only have a proposed solution, which is completely unproven. The only three underground repositories that have actually been used to store radioactive waste have failed. There are two in Germany, which were complete failures, and one in Carlsbad, New Mexico, which was also a failure. These were not for high-level waste, but for much less radioactive intermediate-level waste. The position of CCNR is that we do not have a proven solution for radioactive waste disposal, and therefore we should not be abandoning it. The purpose of the industry is to bury it and walk away from it eventually, to abandon the waste underground. And that means that it's no longer their problem, it's now our problem. We believe that it should not be abandoned, that it should be maintained in a retrievable form, and it should be stored in very robust containers away from major water bodies, but not made inaccessible. It should be retrievable and monitored. And really, we should stop making this waste. The industry has not really met its obligation to prove that they can safely dispose of this material for eternity.
Alicia, what is your background and how have you become involved in these issues?
I've been an environmentalist since my teens, and I did a lot of activism around pipeline work, living in areas in Hamilton at one point in my life where I was working for environmental defense and lobbying against Line 9. And then when I moved back to Thunder Bay, another pipeline they were proposing was Energy East Pipeline. And then so doing work opposing that pipeline. And within my universities, I was working divestment campaigns from fossil fuels. And then I moved back to Thunder Bay, and now they're looking to store the nuclear waste, of course, in the Rebel Lake site. And I don't know if you're in Canada, but to get to Ignace, where the proposed repository is, you have to pass Thunder Bay. That's where I live. So these projects keep coming to where I'm living. And so I've just been aware of them and don't want them to happen and want to protect and save this beautiful area, part of the world that I live, the waters that are here and the fresh water we have. I started a group with others last summer. That's Niniboytum and Anishinaabe Aki. We stand up for Mother Earth. That's in Anishinaabe Mohin. And we have members from Robinson Superior, Treaty 9 and Treaty 3. And we've been meeting on the phone and doing activism with various First Nations along the transportation corridor, putting education out there, getting communities to sign BCRs opposing the transportation through our traditional territories. Niniboytum and Anishinaabe Aki.
When I first started doing Nuclear Hot Seat, there was a concerted effort to create a deep geologic repository on the shores of Lake Erie, which was right next to, I believe, the Bruce nuclear plant. That was shut down. How did that process happen and who was behind the push to stop it?
Just a correction, it's not on Lake Erie. There was a proposal to very not high level waste, which is the irradiated nuclear fuel, which is by far the most radioactive of all the classes of radioactive waste, but to bury low and intermediate level waste. This is all the other radioactive waste other than spent nuclear fuel. They wanted to build a deep geological repository to put all that intermediate level waste deep underground, right beside Lake Huron, not Lake Erie, right beside Lake Huron at a place called Kincardine. That was actually canceled. That project was canceled. They're not going to do it. And the reason why was because the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation, whose land this is on, voted by an overwhelming majority not to accept, not to agree to the burial of the waste on their land. Now, on the same land, but a little further inland, they're looking for a deep geological repository for the much more radioactive high-level waste. And once again, the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation has not yet pronounced itself. But if they say no to that, that will also not go ahead. The Nuclear Waste Management Organization, which is in charge of this project to find a site for the deep geological repository, has already stated that if the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation is not in favor of this, does not approve of it, it will not happen. So that leaves the area which Alicia is talking about, which is north of Lake Superior.
You've mentioned the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, or NWMO. What is that group? Who funds it? What does it consist of? And what has its mission been?
Well, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization is owned and operated by the people who produce the nuclear waste. That is the three utilities in Canada which have had nuclear reactors. That is Ontario Power Generation, which has about 20 reactors that have operated. Hydro-Quebec, which has had two reactors that have operated in the past, both of them shut down permanently. And New Brunswick Power, which has only one reactor operating. But they are the ones who own and operate the Nuclear Waste Management Organization. Strangely enough, the panel that was studying the environmental impact assessment of a deep geological repository concept spent 10 years with public hearings in five provinces. This was called the Seaborne Panel. This was back in the late 80s and 90s. And they unanimously recommended that what Canada needs is a radioactive waste management organization, which is completely independent of the industry. Instead, the government of Canada put the nuclear waste problem into the hands of the very industry that creates the problem. And the difficulty here is that you have a fundamental conflict of interest, because the industry regards it largely as a public relations problem. If they can get this waste underground, then they can continue producing it forever afterwards. They're looking for a route by which they can continue expanding the industry and never stop producing the waste. My organization has pointed out that as long as you have nuclear reactors being built and operating at the surface, you're never going to solve the waste problem, because there's always the waste in the reactors that are operating. And for 30 years after they stop operating, the waste has to be stored on site before it can be moved, before there's any chance of burying it underground. So that means that the on-site danger of catastrophe is not seriously diminished by burying the older spent fuel, because all the new fresh spent fuel is going to be right there at the surface, ready for whatever disaster might happen. So it's kind of a magic trick where you make things disappear, but they don't really disappear. In fact, I heard a recent commentator said, what they want is to create the appearance of disappearance, but it doesn't really disappear. It just appears to disappear. And of course, by putting it underground, you're actually making the problem worse, because in addition to the sites that already exist where the nuclear waste is stored, which are still operating, which will continue to have waste stored there, you also have the transportation through communities like Alicia's community, Thunder Bay. And so there's accident potential all the way along the route. And you're also creating a new site at the terminus of that route where the waste is going to be stored above ground before it is put underground. It turns out you can't just put it directly underground. You have to actually take it apart. You have to take apart the transport packages and repackage the fuel in smaller packages, which are kind of like burial containers, before you can put it underground. So there's lots of opportunity for accidents and for spillages and for radioactive contamination all the way along the line. And at the end of the day, you still haven't solved the problem. Even if the underground repository were reliable, which we don't believe is necessarily true.
Alicia, the fight is now centered on the Ignace area. Is that within the indigenous lands that Gordon has mentioned? And how does that impact local communities and your community as well?
It's about a 4-hour drive west of Thunder Bay along Highway 1. And the problem is the mechanism that the NWMO has created, that this one community gets to decide the willingness, is that community itself is quite a ways from the actual site. It's 45 kilometers away from where Rebel Lake site is. Or there are other indigenous communities closer. Wabagoon Lake, for example, would be the one of the closest First Nation communities, and Saugeen as well, another Saugeen First Nation. And those two communities are in closer proximity of the traditional territory. My First Nation community, Fort William First Nation, is on the transportation corridor, but 4 hours east of that site.
So the waste would be traveling through your community,
yes.
Much like here in the U.S., there's a comparable battle going on with the Pinyon Plain mine, which is contaminating the waters of the Havasupai people. And now they're trying to truck uranium through the Diné, the Navajo Nation, without having any permission. What's wrong with Ignace as a site for a deep geologic repository?
The community, Wabagoon First Nation, just as Gordon had mentioned, that Saugeen will have a vote in the fall. Wabagoon is also allegedly, they're going to be voting to determine their willingness. But what's wrong with the whole willingness process is they've been wheeled and dealed and hustled and bribed. That one community shouldn't be the only community who gets to give their consent. You know, there's many communities, First Nations in that community that need to be part of the decision-making process. And what really irks me is NWMO has given them a decision on this one site, but there's no ability to partake in the whole discussion of nuclear energy use in this country and how do we phase away from this. You get to have one little decision on if you're storing it.
So if Ignace says, yes, we want it, bring it on, but the surrounding First Nations people say, no, we don't want it. Who has final say in this? Who has primacy on this argument?
I do believe NWMO has said that Wabagoon would have a veto. But the irony of Ignace is just accepting the willingness project. This is news in July, is that they got their signing bonus. They got their millions and they've agreed to it, but it wasn't a democratic vote, such as a municipal election. The way they did this, they hired not neutral consultants and they met individually. And the question being asked was, are you in favor of nuclear waste in your area? The question was more is, do you support Ignace moving forward with the willingness process? So the form of the question, the money that has been going into the community for the past decade, it's just sick. And NWMO makes my blood boil.
Gordon, do you have anything to add to that?
The problem is that nuclear waste doesn't mean something clearly defined to most people. They find it very mystifying. They don't know what the nuclear waste is. In fact, these materials that we're talking about, there's hundreds of radioactive materials that are not found in nature, that are created inside the nuclear reactor. And what they are, they're sort of like evil twins of substances that are not radioactive that we do find in nature. For example, in nature, we have elements such as non-radioactive iodine, non-radioactive cesium and strontium, which are in the soil. These are non-radioactive minerals which serve a function in the biosphere. But what the nuclear industry does is it creates radioactive versions of these materials. And the only difference with the radioactive and the non-radioactive materials, they behave exactly the same way in the body and in the food chain, except that the atoms of radioactive materials are unstable. They explode. And when they explode inside your body, they damage the cells and the DNA molecules. And those DNA molecules that are damaged can lead to abnormal growths. And these abnormal growths can lead to cancers, leukemias of different kinds, can also compromise the immune system, can also cause genetic damage. This is damage to the reproductive cells like the eggs and sperm which can then be passed on to future generations. People are not told what radioactivity really is. They're not even told what these radioactive materials are and how they behave. They are told that these fuel bundles, which are about the size of a fireplace log, that that is the radioactive waste, and they're going to bury those fuel bundles way down deep, and so they're not going to come back to the surface. But what they don't tell the people is that the fuel bundles are not really the waste. They are the containers of the waste. When the fuel bundle is cracked or damaged or even develops little pinholes, then the radioactive materials inside leak out. And those radioactive materials can find their way to the surface because they are at an atomic level. And so they can be carried by water. They can be carried by microbial organisms. They can be carried by steam if there's steam generation underground, because these wastes are also hot. And they have to space out the waste in between the two waste bundles, in between two adjacent waste bundles. They have to space out the storage so that the temperature of the water does not exceed 100 degrees, because if it exceeds 100 degrees, you will get steam formed, and that steam can push the waste up to the surface again. And there's also cracks occurred when you dig into an undisturbed geological formation. It's no longer undisturbed. What you do is you create a whole fracture pattern that wasn't there before. The dynamiting, the blasting, the building of the shaft. And because the pressure is disturbed, the geological pressure underground is disturbed by creating this cavity. So further cracking occurs for decades and even centuries after the structure has been built. That creates pathways that weren't there previously. So it's much more complicated than the industry likes to present to people. They present a kind of a comic book version of what it means, instead of a realistic, scientifically based explanation of what we're really talking about.
My understanding is that Indigenous people, the First Nations people of Canada, do have say, final say, over what happens on their own lands, which would include this area around Ignace. And there has been a statement by the First Nations Alliance, which I believe you and your people are part of, Alicia. The statement is, "Our nations have not been consulted, we have not given our consent, and we stand together in saying no to the proposed nuclear waste storage site near Ignace." And NWMO is on record as stating that the proposed deep geologic repository would only move forward with the support of the adjacent Indigenous communities. So why is this still an issue? When is the no accepted as being no? And how are they trying to get around it?
They're not trying to talk to all the communities. Like, I think that's a Chief Turtle quote from their alliance group that came out. So Grassy Narrows is being ignored, like all the non, in their view of what's adjacent. Like Fort William, we're on the transportation line. That's not close enough to get a veto. You know, we don't get a say. They're just taking a very small community that it's going through its own struggles and isn't in a place to make this decision.
They're talking about a very small community of less than 1,000 people. If you give $100,000 or $100 million to a small community like that, it's a huge impact, a huge economic impact. And they've been throwing around millions of dollars for many years. And these people are oftentimes economically depressed to some degree. It's difficult to find well-paying jobs and make enough money to pay all the bills that come your way. And so the money is a strong inducement and introduces kind of an unfairness factor. The other thing is that once they sign an agreement, once they agree to this, they do not have the political or economic clout afterwards to object to anything that happens. And so they're putting NWMO, the waste producers, in the driver's seat. And they're basically putting themselves in a position which makes it extremely difficult for them to. In fact, they even have to sign an agreement which says they will not oppose, the town council, for example, will not oppose this project in future. Now, that's a crazy idea, because what happens if things go badly? In Germany, for example, they had an underground repository for radioactive waste of a lower nature, a low and intermediate level waste. It was called the Asse II salt mine. And they put waste down there for decades. They put radioactive waste down there in the salt mine, saying that it would be perfectly safe and it would stay there. But in fact, it started leaking into the groundwater and into the surface waters. And this leakage occurred for almost 10 years before the nuclear industry mentioned it to the public or to the decision makers. Now the German government has acknowledged that this is a complete fiasco, a complete mistake, and they're actually paying billions of euros, equivalent of 5 billion Canadian dollars, to take the waste out of that underground repository and bring it back to the surface again, because it's too dangerous to leave it where it is. So the problem is this: if you have the industry running the show and in charge of their own waste disposal, why would they blow the whistle on themselves and say, this is not working well, leakage is occurring? Or can we trust them to do the right thing when they themselves have a vested interest in making sure that this appears to be foolproof, which is what they've always presented it as, a foolproof idea? It's not a foolproof idea, because the fool is always bigger than the proof.
In looking at the strictures that were placed on any community that signs on to this, they have 45 days to bring up any objections. But from that point on, it is a total gag order. They can't say anything. They can't comment. They can't object. They can't do anything. And also, any communications, and this I found particularly diabolical, any communications they might want to release has to go through NWMO or whatever their identified communications group is for approval before they get a chance to release it. It cannot come directly from the community. So I see that as just a banana peel to slip on and make certain that you can never say anything again. Alicia, going back to the point that you made, it seems that with NWMO on record as stating that they would only move forward with the support of adjacent Indigenous communities, they are banking a lot on the word adjacent to exclude any other voices. Would you say that that's accurate?
Yeah.
And who would be excluded?
Everybody else, all the other Indigenous communities who are on the transportation route, who are upstream, downstream, even people who are in Treaty 9 and communities that aren't on, that travel down and they come for medical, they come for work. It's a huge population they're ignoring. But it's harder to bribe a larger people. So you structure, you design the approval system in your favor.
I agree with that. The point is that there's no real reason why the waste has to be buried without any assurance that it's going to be safe, particularly when they have an idea of abandoning it. We believe that this idea of abandoning the waste is both unscientific and unethical. We're talking here about the most poisonous poisons ever made by any industry. It's going to remain dangerous for periods of time that dwarf the span of human history. For example, the pyramids of Egypt are only 5,000 years old. These things are lasting for millions of years and pose dangers for countless generations to come. So to think that you can just walk away from this is fundamentally irresponsible. And there was, in fact, a statement which included that point by the Anishinaabeg Nation and the Iroquois Alliance. They formed an alliance between the Iroquois Caucus and the Anishinaabeg Nation opposing the current philosophy. They said, number one, these wastes should not be abandoned. They're too dangerous to be abandoned. They should be kept retrievable and monitored. Number two, they should be away from bodies of water, major bodies of water. Number three, they should require the consent of the people for whom the waste is being transported through their territory. And in fact, they should not be moved unless there's a provable way of demonstrating that it's going to be safer where it's going to compared with where it's coming from. Now, that's also debatable, because where it's coming from is where all the economic and political power is and where the nuclear expertise is. In other words, where it is right now, you have nuclear experts who can quickly detect any radiation leaks and who can quickly take action to correct the leakage and repair it. When you move it to a remote community, that expertise is no longer present. And so you're lacking the expertise needed to deal with emergencies. That would be less important if it weren't for the fact that they are going to have to repackage the waste when it arrives at this remote site. In other words, they have to take the fuel bundles out of the existing transport containers and put them into new containers. To do this, they need to build special facilities called hot cells, which have windows that are 3 feet thick of glass to protect the workers who have to use remote robotic arms in order to do the manipulation of the fuel. At that point, it's quite possible to have serious accidents occur. because handling these fuel bundles is very dangerous. Since they came out of the reactor, they have never been handled individually before. So that any damage to the fuel bundles causes major leakage. This happens inside a reactor when you have what are called fuel failures, and radioactive material goes all through the cooling system as a result of leakage from the fuel bundles, which does occur. Well, up there where they're going to be burying the waste, there's going to be a similar danger of fuel leakage because you're handling millions of fuel bundles one at a time and putting them into other containers than the ones they started out in. So the question arises, why is this not all being done back where the expertise is? It should be done back where the waste was produced by the people who have the most knowledge about the nature of the waste and the most ability to handle any emergency that comes up. So what we're talking about here is literally an out of sight, out of mind idea. Let's get it out of sight, and then people will tend to regard it as a non-problem. And then we can just go on and produce more and more waste by building more and more reactors, never really solving the problem, but perpetuating the problem.
Where does it stand now with Ignace? Where are they in the process, and what's up next, and what is being done to oppose them?
I'd mentioned they had signed their willingness agreement. And so now we're waiting for South Bruce to see if they're going to have their vote in the fall, I believe September. And then site selection, NWMO will make a choice between either community.
And if they are opposed by First Nations groups, how does that settle out? How is that figured?
Then I believe that NWMO opens up the site selection to communities to come forward again.
It's important to point out that the Canadian government, like many other governments, has signed treaties with Indigenous people, which they have ignored. They have violated the terms of these treaties repeatedly, and they still are. They have obligations which are legally binding, which they have simply not carried out. There are case after case after case of this happening. So the only thing that has given the First Nations some power in this is the Supreme Court of Canada. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled against the government of Canada that you cannot ignore these treaties. These are legally binding documents. You have to obey what is written down in these treaties. And if the courts have to intervene, then that may be necessary, because it's only the courts that have given force to the treaties that were being broken and ignored by the government of Canada and by the other governments, the provincial governments as well. So when push comes to shove, the government of Canada, who is promoting nuclear power and always has from day one, promoting it both at home and abroad, they would like to see this enterprise go forward, and they would like to see this waste out of sight and out of mind. So they are at one with the nuclear industry in that regard. But First Nations people, the Indigenous people, actually have more legal rights than the non-Indigenous people, but they don't have the economic and political clout to enforce their will except through the courts.
So what is next in terms of resistance by the First Nations people, by any of the other perhaps sane individuals who aren't Indigenous but are becoming aware of what the dangers are and might side with you?
Darlene Nican has been a force. She's from Saugeen First Nation and has been doing water walks the last weekend in September. She has another one planned. I think this will be her fourth site. She walks the highway all the way to the rebel site, I believe, leaving from Sulakot, is one example.
What can be done to support the pushback against WMO and this sighting of the Deep Geological Repository in Ignace?
I think people have to wake up and realize that the industry is not wanting to solve the health and safety problems associated with nuclear waste so much as their own public relations problem to go ahead and build more reactors. I think the people should say, no, we don't want this waste. We don't want this waste being produced anymore. And we don't want it being dumped on a community which is helpless to really deal with the waste should things go wrong, which we believe they will. We have advocated, our organization, Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, has said that until the industry phases out nuclear power and stops producing the waste, these wastes should be kept on site where they're produced, and they should be kept under close surveillance. They should be in a program that we call rolling stewardship. We do know how to package the waste for decades at a time and even centuries at a time, but we don't know how to package them forever. That means that we have to repackage them and we have to improve the packaging as time goes on. So what we need is a process of rolling stewardship whereby the money and the resources and the authority is made available to guard these wastes very carefully, put them into very robust containers, repackage them as necessary, and always with an idea of improving the containment and protecting the environment against getting these materials into the food chain, into the water. That's the most dangerous thing, because once it gets into the food chain and the water, it spreads all over the territory. It doesn't just remain in one location. So the idea that only the adjacent communities are affected is on the assumption that everything goes exactly as planned. And when things do not go exactly as planned, look at Fukushima, look at Chernobyl, look at the spread of radioactive materials over thousands and thousands of miles. That's what you can expect from a waste repository when the waste repository fails. That's what happened in Germany with low and intermediate level waste buried deep underground and now being removed from that underground repository because it has been leaking into the water systems.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you think we need to get in now?
I believe that one thing that people should be saying is that the wrong people are in charge. We do need nuclear expertise in order to deal with these wastes, but they should not be calling the shots. They should not be the ones making the decisions. The decision should be made by people outside of the industry, independent of the industry, whose only concern is protecting the health and safety of people and the environment. And that was the unanimous recommendation of the Seaborne panel many years ago, back in 1998, when this whole process was started. It was the government of Canada that refused to obey their recommendation to make such an agency independent of the industry who really make the decisions. That agency would be much more even-handed, much more likely to weigh the pros and cons, much more likely to listen to the people who really count. And those are the people who will suffer the consequences, not the people who are making the waste.
One thing we were working with the Chief of Fort William First Nation was to call for Indigenous-led regional assessment. And so that's something that we'll continue to try and put in place.
Well, I invite both of you to continue to keep me updated on any developments. And for now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat. Dr. Gordon Edwards is head of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, and Alicia Petrone is a board member for Mining Watch Canada and a member of the Ninipotamin Anishinaabe Aki, an Indigenous-led group dedicated to stopping the disposal of nuclear waste in Anishinaabe territory. I'll have links and a downloadable document outlining the Anishinaabe concerns about radioactive waste disposal on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 687. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 20th, 2024. To get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, so you don't miss a single episode, we make it easy. Sign up by going to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, and filling out the yellow box with your first name and an email address. Every week, you will get one email with the link to the show and a short description of its content. You can also sign up on any of your favorite podcast platforms. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevy and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevy of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, nuclear kills two ways, fast by blast, slow by glow, that glow being radioactivity and the long-term health damage it creates when we are exposed to it. There you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.